This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week, as usual, is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
I thought we'd lost you for a moment. On this week's show, we have Dustin Hoffman in an Italian thriller called Into the Labyrinth. Then we got Richard Grieco. In Attack of the Unknown. Then we're going to follow that up with the new sci-fi movie Portal, and we're going to wind up with a few drinks in the Oak Room. Our short shot this week is C600 and C600 Infiltration, a twofer for once. And we're going to wind up in the DTV throwback with Mercenary for Justice with a certain Steven Seagal. So, without further ado, let's crack on. Our first film then is Into the Labyrinth. 15 years ago, teenager Samantha Andretti was abducted and disappeared without a trace. Now she has been found, having managed to finally escape her captor, albeit with a broken leg and little memory of her ordeal. While a Dr. Green tries to help her remember, a debt collector called Bruno Genko tries to find the kidnapper. However, Genko himself is on borrowed time. Okay, so this is apparently based on an international bestseller, as they say. Co-stars Dustin Hoffman in the role of Dr. Green. Now, we did sort of like speculate, didn't we, guys, as to how much involvement Dustin Hoffman would actually have in the running of this film. And lo and behold, yeah. what we actually have here are two very sort of separate narratives, albeit to do with the same thing. So on the one hand, we've got Dr. Green, Dustin Hoffman's character, sat in the hospital talking to Samantha, trying to sort of like draw out details of sort of 15 years of her ordeal. And on the other hand, we've got Genko, this elderly debt collector, or very talented debt collector, who's on borrowed time. He's had some bad news. He knows his days are numbered, and he just wants to sort of put this to bed. He was implored by Samantha's parents when she first was abducted to investigate, and he said, "Well, no, because the police have got no leads. There's nothing to go on here." So he wants to make amends. So how did this sort of play out for you guys? Let's go to Steve to begin with.
I don't know what to make of it, really. One thing I would recommend is do not watch the trailer, because I saw the trailer for this a few months ago and it gives away the ending, really.
Right.
It moves at a snail's pace. It's one of them, kind of reminded me like a 90s thriller throwback type thing, you know, like...
Yeah. Sort of post-Silence of the Lambs.
Or
yeah.
Seven.
Yeah,
exactly. That kind of thing. Performances were good, but it's just a bit too... I still don't know what happened at the end, to be fair.
we'll come on to that. We'll circle back to that later on, yeah.
Yeah, it really confused me, but, you know, it's well shot, it's well acted. I thought the performances were really good. Even though it is basically... It's an Italian film. It's, you know, there's only... two characters, I think, who speak English, and that's Dustin Hoffman and the girl.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's just plot holes abound to me, and it just didn't gel as well as I thought it was going to. Very, very confusing to me, honestly. Yeah. I really, really, really lost me at the end.
I think you're certainly right as far as, you know, the two narrative strands. You know, you're watching the film, and it sort of spends, you know, it switches between the two narratives, but at no point is any attempt made to sort of join them up. You know, So Zenko finds out stuff, you know, or Dr. Green finds out stuff, and neither find out what is going on. I mean, we find out why a bit later in the film, but, you know, you're kind of waiting for this, you know, for the two to marry up, and it just doesn't happen. Rich, what did you make of this one?
Well, just to step in on that point, I mean, they do, that is kind of where it's leading to, and it does come to that point at the end. I was really looking forward to it, but I was hesitant going in because it's 2 hours, 10 minutes long. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I was kind of putting off actually sitting down and watching it. But when I started it, I knew that I was, you know, this was my kind of film. I was going to enjoy it. I thought the whole, the style of it, you know, the aesthetics, the production design and whatever, and the cinematography as two key features are, you know, a top class.
Absolutely.
Dustin Hoffman is there from the beginning. He's really good. There's a lot of really, but it is a total head scratcher of a film, and I so want to watch it again, or to go back to the novel, which funnily enough, the director of the film is the novelist. So he adapted his own. Apparently, this was the second time that he'd done that, because he did a film called, which was released internationally as The Girl in the Fog 2 years previously, also with the same actor, the same Italian actor, Tony Servillo. So they're not related, but it was another thriller based, adapted from one of his books or whatever. So I'm wondering, will that, if I do the book, is that going to sort of fill in some of the gaps for me, and or can I just go back and watch the film and tie it all together? Because the clues are there, and there's a lot of stuff that I was picking up on when I'm watching it. You know, symbolism seems to be quite a key thing. There's the whole thing about the rabbit or bunny, you know, and you know, if the girl was called Alice, you know, you kind of know a bit where you were standing, because there is a whole kind of fairy tale quality to it. There's also, going back to the production design, you know, there's these grand, often coloured red rooms. So he goes to visit his friend, lover, who's a prostitute or whatever. And, you know, she's got quite an elaborate place. Later, she goes to visit another guy's wife who's involved in the case. And that room is like really red. And on the outside, there's things like, I think they talk about like a fire that's raging. So there's a whole kind of, is this like a Dante's Inferno? You know, like is this a limbo, sort of hell kind of thing that's happening? Is this really happening, or is this like in his head, or is he, you know, is he dead or something? You just don't know. But the, you know, the rabbit stuff is all quite puzzling. And did you notice the number 23?
No, I didn't actually.
Because pops up like two or three places, like on the girl in the girl who's being interviewed, you know, by Green. It's on the telephone that sits next to her. Mm. It's also on the door of the labyrinth. It says 2323. And there's a couple of other references as well, which I won't mention anymore. But the But what that means, again, I don't know. It's like, what is, I know the number 23 has that significance, which was why they made the whole Jim Carrey psychological thriller about it. Yeah. But I don't know how that plays. But yeah, I mean, I just really want to go back and sort of like start putting the piece. This is like a bit like a Christopher Nolan kind of movie for me. It's hard work, but it's very slick, very stylish, very engaging, and feels like, you know, the more you put it, you know, more effort you put into it, the more you're going to get out of it, you know, going back and you know, trying to fill in some of the gap. Also, I sometimes feel that way about some of the Brian De Palma films that I've seen. You know, you get that twist ending, whatever, and you go back and you can see it. So I rated this one a lot.
I'm with you on this, Rich. I really like this. I like the aesthetic of it. Like, for example, the the Bureau of Lost Children or whatever it's called. You know.
That, oh man, yeah, that's, you know, yeah,
that,
crazy.
That whole thing is really, really cool. You know, bits of the labyrinth, as you say, you know, sort of being bathed in red and all that. It works really well. What doesn't work very well is the ending. We're not going to spoil it or anything. But it comes to a point in this film, as you mentioned, it's 2 hours, 10 minutes long already. And it's almost as if the film becomes conscious of how long itself is, because it rushes the ending. You know, it tries to wrap up and sort of drop all these revelations right at the end. And it is really confusing. There's a person trying to escape by ladder. You know, she's climbing up a ladder, and then it intercuts with the office of the Missing Persons Bureau. And I'm looking at this going, is she going to pop up in the middle of the Missing Persons Bureau? is it going to turn out there's a secret compartment or something in there? Because you just don't know. You know, it was really weird, really weirdly edited. And, it's trying to tease you as to what's going on. And it literally comes down to a news story right at the end to sort of explain an element of what was been going on. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still, I kind of get it, but I do need to go back.
I just think they rushed it. You know,
So let's backtrack. If I can backtrack. Okay, go on.
Having said that, right, when I was watching it, there's a death quite near the end, quite a big, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked, and there was still half an hour left.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, how are they going to drag this out? And oh my God, they did drag it out. And
it's an interesting twist, you know.
Yeah.
But I was the same as you. I was thinking, but they've solved it, surely. You know, and it's, and but it, you're right. Yeah, and then it just keeps going. It's weird.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I did enjoy it. I'm not slagging it off, but I just think they could have easily lost 20 minutes, half an hour out of it, you know, just to get it that bit more tighter. And I think that would have amped up the atmosphere and the tension, to be fair.
Mm. How about let's talk about Dustin Hoffman being in this. How do you find his performance, Steve?
It's Dustin Hoffman. You know, he is a legend. He's, and there's a reason. I mean, like you say, he's probably what got about 3-4 days on it, really. If
probably,
that.
Yeah.
But and he's basically in one setup, one scene, but. Because it is spread throughout the film, it's not like, you know, it's a decent part. And I thought he's great in it. You know, he just does what he does. I mean, there's one coming up later that we're going to talk about later on where there's a cameo in that. And she's listed, and she's in it for 20 seconds. But we'll get into that one in a bit.
Yeah, sure. Rich, yeah.
Yeah, I thought Hoffman was great. I mean, he committed to it as well as he does. I mean, I felt like his character in this was not far removed from his character in Outbreak, because they're both sort of people in the medical. I mean, I know he's a psychologist or whatever, but his delivery and everything is essentially the same. He's playing this kind of character who's dealing with these serious things, but then he's going sort of saying this. This sort of offhanded kind of thing, and you don't know quite what's happening with his character and that. But his delivery and everything's great. I mean, there is that question mark of why are these scenes in English? Why is he talking to her? You know, she's an Italian. Why are they talking in English? But is that just an Italian film being an Italian film? Because Italian films have been importing American stars, you know, for a long time. You know, whether it was Fred Williamson or whoever, you know, that was the whole thing about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, wasn't it? You know,
yeah.
You go, your career's ended here. You go over to go over to Italy. But it's a really good role for him. And again, it's not like one of these. You know,
it's not a Bruce Willis role, is it?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's not like that. Although you could be annoyed that actually he's not in it that much. Mm-hmm. But they do periodically keep coming back to
he adds something to the film.
That's he does add something to it, definitely. Yeah, and she's really good as well. The Samantha actress Valentina Bell playing opposite him. You know, that because that's I don't know what her career is or anything, but you know, it's a two-hander between them two. You know, that's you got to hold your own with Dustin Hoffman.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely up to the game probably, but yeah. This is quite a surprise. I wasn't looking forward to covering this, I must admit. But, you know, on paper, it does sort of sound a bit desperate having, you know, getting Dustin Hoffman to appear in your Italian movie. It's like, you know, as you said, typical sort of Italian exploitation. But it's not this, you know, it does fit into that sort of genre of sort of Silence of the Lambs and what's the one that Christopher Lambert did? Night Moves, was it Night Moves?
Oh, yeah, Night Moves, or even something like Crimson Rivers and
that sort of thing. It does fit into that sort of, you know, sort of diabolical killer slash kidnapper kind of thing. Yeah, The Bone Collector, you know, is sort of Denzel Washington. It definitely fits in with those sort of films and it holds its own. So scores on the doors, guys. I'm giving this a 7 out of 10. Rich?
I'll go with 7.
I'm gonna go for an 8 on this. I really, really liked it a lot. I think as soon as I watched it, I had to go back and I rewatched a couple of the opening scenes. There was just something I wanted to back. I was trying to sort of interrupt earlier. The opening scene is itself quite odd because that's like a kidnapping scene, and the way the girl doesn't react to seeing this, you know.
Yeah.
Head with glowing eyes, whatever. That all makes it, it's like, is this real or is you know what's going on here? Why what? There, it almost seems like supernatural, you know, the way she because she stops and she's like doing her makeup in a van, and then she sees some glowing lights and the door opens and pulls her in, and it pulls her in like in a horror movie, like a demon, grabbing her by the waist and but she doesn't scream or anything. It's really strange, but.
Okay,
it's that kind of puzzling thing that sort of sets it up, I guess.
Right. So you've just sort of knocked over a memory in my head about this film. There's a bit where Zenko figures out because we find out that an anonymous tip was given to the police about the girl, and he listens to the tape and he figures out who it is. So he goes to see this person, and while he's talking to him, he seems to have a premonition of what's going to happen in that bar, because he knows that the police are going to come barging in and throwing tear gas and shit to arrest him. And then he leaves, and then it happens. So we see it happening in his head, sort of thing.
Yeah, I know. I remember the bit you're talking about.
Yeah, it was weird, because it never happens again. Because I'm thinking, oh, he can see into the future, can he? And then he never shows that ability ever again. You know, he's getting knocked out from behind and stuff. It would have been quite useful to have that in the back pocket.
I mean, that's the thing as well. I mean, it kind of hints at like supernatural elements to it. But there isn't. It just kind of just gives you that little snippet that maybe there might be something, and then there isn't. There's nothing there at all. I mean, like the comic book. That was great. I really enjoyed that, and how it's designed and everything like that. That was cracking, and what they did with it. But then nothing else really more comes of it.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay,
it's definitely an oddity.
It is.
I highly recommend it. I think it's definitely worth the check out. Yeah, it's great. It's got something special about it.
Yeah, so it's 2 sevens and an 8 for Into the Labyrinth. Go check it out. Our next film is Attack of the Unknown. When a SWAT team is given the task of escorting dangerous cartel member Miguel Aguirre, their mission becomes much worse when a giant alien spaceship hovers over the city and unleashes a wave of destruction as its extraterrestrial soldiers start to harvest human blood. Trapped in the local jailhouse, the team must work with the inmates, including Miguel, if they are to survive. Interesting structure to this one, guys. The first 20 minutes of this basically plays out like a cheap TV episode of your sort of just about any sort of generic cop show from the last 20 years. And then we get sort of like the bargain basement Independence Day sort of shenanigans on top. With a bit of sort of Predator backstory kind of stuff going on as well. I stand by this. I actually like this a lot. For all its cheapness, I think there's a lot of heart gone into this one. But I'm very interested to hear what you guys got to say about it. So let's go to Steve.
I knew you were going to do that. Right. I knew you were going to bring it to me first. It was awful. It really was. The performances were terrible. The special effects were awful. The only decent effects were the actual cityscape. They were quite good. But then you've got the creatures, which they were better in V in the 80s, to be fair. It was just bad, bad, bad. I mean, the only person who comes away with anything is Richard Grieco, and that's because he sounds like he's been smoking 60 fags a day. And he's just so gruff and manly, you can hardly hear him. But as I was saying before, right, Tara Reid has got a fifth billing in this.
Mm.
Yeah?
She's
literally in it for 30 seconds.
Mm.
Playing a Mexican missionary or something like that. And that's it. Then she's gone, never to be seen again. I'm like, is that it?
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it's your Independence Day assault on Precinct 13 thrown together, and it is terrible. I'll be honest, I didn't enjoy it at all.
Rich, did you find any redeeming features in this one?
I found it quite a slog, to be honest. It does feel like an asylum movie with a slightly bigger budget. Steve, I actually did like quite a few of the visual effects. I thought there was some nice bits going on. The assault on Precinct 13 thing again. I picked up. I actually wrote in my notebook "Alien Assault on Precinct 13" because that's basically what it is. The opening SWAT team assault on the drug dealers part that you mentioned, Mike, is completely unnecessary. Basically. I mean, it kind of sets up the tough guy characters or whatever, but it's not as... I mean, again, a bit like the previous film, I went into this film going, "Oh, that looks a bit long," because a film like this shouldn't be over 100 minutes long.
Yeah.
This should have been 75, 80, or, you know, something like that. You know, get in, you know, get on, go. It's also quite a joyless film. Richard Grieco is taking it very, very seriously. And... you know, it gets quite depressing at times with some of the themes. But I did like the casting of Robert Lozado, who's he's basically like...
He's a stalwart villain, isn't he, basically?
Yeah, he's like second to Danny Trejo, basically, in terms of Mexican gangsters and stuff. He has quite a lot to work with here, which is great. But his character, the conclusion to his involvement in it is having a showdown with the alien where he's like, "You made, hey, Dad, good to see you, Dad. You made me like this." What is going on? Why is he talking to this alien like this? That made no sense. This, for me, reminded me a lot of another film that I didn't get on with, which I know you really like, Mike, which was Daylight's End.
Mm.
The setup and the sort of environment seemed very, very similar. And I didn't really get on with that either. This was kind of like, we've seen a lot of, you know, special forces SWAT teams versus aliens kind of movies. We've seen a couple of, one or two at least. I mean, Blackout, Invasion Earth, Russian film. Mm-hmm. That did this kind of theme, for my money, much more, did a lot more interesting stuff with it. But also, even if you look at, you know, this, I watch this, I think of Skyline, you know, the Skyline franchise and what they've done there. I mean, you know, this is crying out for a Frank Grillo, you know, leading it. I think that would have changed. That could potentially, you know, if it was in, is it Liam Cunningham's hands, you know, this was made by Brandon Slagle, who previously did, what was it called? Crossover, Crosswalk. It was the one with Vivica Fox and Stephen Baldwin, I want to say. It's like the sci-fi. So, you know, he's into his sci-fi and that. I don't know if I've seen any of his other films, to be honest. But this one, you know, I can see there's potential. You know, I'd watch something else he's made because it's nicely shot. There's a good ensemble. You know, there's some good positive aspects. But for me, I just wasn't into it at all. I like the fact they did practical aliens. Although it's a bit silly, you know, that their mouths can't really move and that, you know, they're trying. I couldn't go with it. And for me, Richard Grieco was, you know, too dour. I wasn't having much fun with his character. A couple of the support guys, you know, there's the social media guy who gets pulled into it and, you know, he's just touring about. That adds a bit of fun to it a little bit, but there needed to be more of that, I think. Bit more humor.
I thought there was humor in this. There's there's a good scene early on with the two patrol officers when they sort of get called out to some area and they think, oh, some sort of electrical disturbance. And I thought their dialogue scene was actually quite good. So leading up to that, it was quite playful in that. So yeah, all the stuff in the nightclub or the bar or whatever it is, they sort of hang out in afterwards. Thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, God. No, I didn't like that. Yeah. Why is it these, you mean, it's like the Expendables and stuff, isn't it? Why is it they've always gone on a mission and then they will go out to a topless bar or something? Yeah. I mean, that's great. Sick of each other. Quite
no, I must admit, I quite like this. I mean, it is too long. It's very cheap, but I don't know. There's just something there about it. It just sort of worked for me. But there you go. Nice sort of, you know, sort of downbeat ending as well. Sort of leaves it reasonably open ended. We you know, we might get Attack of the Unknown 2 with Richard, with Frank Grillo. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that kind of that open world ending kind of thing is another thing that made me think of like Skylines, you know, the sort of building they're trying to develop this and, you know, create something bigger. It's just I think if they'd have trimmed it down, even if they'd have just trimmed it down, a shorter cut might have just done the trick. Yeah. I don't know.
I think you're right. It did need to be shorter, that's for sure. I mean, it's what, 1 hour 40 or something like that?
Yeah, 1 hour 43.
It's too long. Anyway, scores on the doors. I'm going to throw it open with a 6 out of 10. Rich?
I'm going to go for a... Because I found it a bit of a slog. I am going to have to go for like a 5, I think.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Last week you gave For the Sake of Vicious a 4. Are you saying that For the Sake of Vicious was worse than this?
Maybe. Well, the thing is,
it's totally different. It's happening. No, I'm being unfair.
No, but I'm going to say. But a big problem I had with For the Sake of Vicious was I didn't really feel that they were conveying very what was happening, what the plot was, what the story was. It was just, you know, I didn't connect with it. With this, I followed the story. Had no problem there. it was very, very clear what was happening. So I got no issues with that. So that's why it earns an extra point.
Okay.
Because I could follow the plot.
Steve.
I'm going 4.
Okay. So this gets a 4, a 5, and a 6 from the DTV Digest. Go check it out. Our next review is Portal. Mysterious monoliths begin appearing all across the globe. And that's all you need to know, because that is all the film tells you. So what we actually have here, guys, is 4 or 5 vignettes all about these weird monoliths which have started appearing around the world. Thanks to an intrepid podcaster slash radio broadcaster who fills us in with loads of exposition, sort of moving things along a bit, because nobody else is telling us fuck all in this film. Mm-hmm. The film starts really, really well with these five or six kids taking an exam. And then in the middle of this, there's this sort of cataclysmic event, you know, these monoliths start appearing. And we sort of, you know, get information piecemeal in the same way these kids do. It actually reminded me of a Japanese film called, something Classroom it was called. But anyway, so these kids got no idea what's going on. Their fucking teacher's done a runner, left them in the lurch. And they find, you know, in the hallway of the school is this thing. So this thing, you know, this opening I thought was great, brilliant. And then it cuts to a different story and we never find out what happened to these kids at all. And then we get this other story and you never find out what happens to the people in these stories at all. It just goes from one to the other. It's just all set up and no bloody payoff. I found this incredibly pretentious and frustrating to watch. How about you? Let's start with Rich.
Yeah, I think it is more a collection. It's a collection of short films kind of thing. I know it's not that, but you know, it was conceived as a whole project, but it's you are watching a series of stories set within the same universe where the same thing has happened, but they're, you know, different encounters, different things. So they call the first thing I want to go back is to take issue with the title change that they've done. The original title was Doors, which is what they refer to these monoliths in the world. That, you know, you've got to stay away from these doors. They don't know what's going to happen, what happens when you get near these doors and stuff. They changed it to Portal, singular, which I don't think that fits, because one, yeah, there's more than one, and also is it a portal? We don't know, because we don't really know what they are, what they do. So I suppose they are, because at one point they go in, there's a house and whatever, but it's all it's trying to do that whole 2001 sort of psycho, you know, is it? I don't know. It's like an alien consciousness and all this sort of stuff.
They go to great pains to design the monoliths so they don't look like Kubrick's monoliths. You know, they got a different sort of texture to them, and they're not just one sort of shape, as it were. So, you know, there's that as well.
Yeah, what they seem to have done is they've come up with this concept, and instead of it, it's not the work of one director, one writer. It is five, if you include the wraparound sort of exposition, the middle bits and stuff, interstitials they refer to them in the credits. So there's five sets of filmmakers all working separately on something connected to the same thing. So that's why, you know, one story finishes, another one begins. It's an anthology kind of thing, which I'm not against that. But like you, Mike, I think I would have liked a bit more clarity, a bit more exposition, a bit more payoff. Yeah, because the problem with these kinds of stories is if you, I mean, let's think of some of the classic anthologies is, you know, even if you go back to Atticus films and whatever, Tales from the Crypt and that, the stories have beginning, middle and end.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they're generally not related. Because this is happening in a world where everything's related, but they don't want to pay anything, you know, conclude anything, leaving things open for interpretation, whatever, it's not satisfying. So by the time you get to the end, the ending part isn't really isn't a satisfying ending. It's kind of we've come to, you know, fills in a couple of the gaps, but still just sort of leaving it open for more stories that might develop this along the line. So I liked it. I thought, you know, there's some very, very creative, very interesting ideas, very good visuals, and, you know, it's great. And if I was watching these on Dust or something, one after another, I probably wouldn't have a problem with it. But as a coherent film, it does leave you a bit unsatisfied.
Yeah, I had no idea going into this that I was about to watch an anthology.
Nor did I.
No.
Steve, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I agree with you too, to be fair. I thought it started off great and then it took a nosedive, really. Like I say, I didn't even realise it was an anthology until the end, you know, and it had different directors
coming
up on the credits.
Yeah.
I just thought it was just trying to really to interconnect the stories. They're just trying to interconnect the stories, but not enough. You know, it's like, okay, they've turned up, millions have gone missing, we'll show you inside of one, and then we'll do this Alex Jones thing on Zoom, and that's it. And it was like, seriously? You know, because
the bit at the end with the spaced out guy, that wasn't very good, really.
No. That was one of my favorite bits.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Hey,
the
alien. Oh, whatever this.
Yeah. So I mean, the first section I thought was quite interesting. You know, it builds attention and it works, and then after that, you just. Like you say, you don't know what's happened to him or anything like that. All you know is that they've had an argument and it just ends. And it's frustrating. It's annoying because you spend 20, 25 minutes with these characters and you kind of want to know. And then it just gives you nothing whatsoever. It just moves on to somebody else. And then even this, like the second one where it's go inside. What they call knockers or something that they've got to go in.
The knockers.
And it, you know, again, that doesn't really, I know it's not supposed to make sense, it's supposed to be all weird and mystical and blah blah blah, but there's nothing there to it. It's just we're walking or we'll split up.
Yeah. And how fucking super was that?
We've got 15 minutes. Oh no, we've got 12. Oh, right. Well, let's go as far away from this door as we can and then fuck everything like that. Yeah, it was. You're right, Matt. It pissed me off, I'll be honest.
It
really did.
I liked, there was some humour in it that I liked. You know, some little quirky bits of humour that they added in, which I like. But, and you know, it is trying to be thoughtful and contemplative, but, you know, it's a real shame because, as I was saying, the production design. Also, want to highlight the sound design. I mean, the sound design is a very key part of it, where the way that the doors communicate and stuff like that. That's all, you know, terrifically done. I think my main problem is this as a film experience. I think if I was watching these as separate, thought-provoking shorts, as you know, like a series, like a web series or something, I don't think I would have the same issue with it.
Yeah,
it was another. I mean, you know, I think this is one of the things that is highlighted by the fact by its episodic nature is, you know, they tried to sort of stitch it together with the radio host sort of filling people in what's going on, you know, and so between the first and second story, we get the whole thing where he's sort of saying this project, you know, which is coming up, you know, where we've got these knockers, these guys have volunteered to sort of go into the monolith to sort of see what happens. And then the episode starts and we get all these caption cards coming up telling us exactly the same thing that he's just told us in the interim, you know, because as you say, you know, these things have been done in separation, you know, in isolation. So obviously, you know, the person directing or making the second story feels the need to sort of explain what he's doing with these characters, even though the radio host has already filled us in. So you know, you get this sort of duplication of information, sort of going on. But I, you know, as you said, the individual stories, you are drawn in. I mean, you know, the woman in the second story, you know, who's a sort of self-professed Star Trek nerd, which I thought was quite good. You know, sort of referring to a gun as a phaser, you know, it's not a gun, it's a phaser. I thought it was, you know, and it sort of gets her out of a sort of situation that she gets herself into. So, yeah, I enjoyed, you know, this, as you said, some of the stories as they were going on. I did like that Zoom call at the end. I wasn't expecting it. I thought the film would more or less ended by then. But you actually get some more information about what the monoliths are actually there to do from that conversation, which sort of makes it even more sort of creepy, which is really good. So it gives it more of a sort of Outer Limits sort of feel, you know, rather than a sort of Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's great to look at, you know. I mean, cinematography and everything is really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, the actual design of the doors as well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was great. They looked really good.
Yeah,
it's just it's a bit different. It's like you know, you're on a magnet over shavings or something like that.
Yeah, iron filings. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it really works. I think it looked really good.
Yeah, it does give it sort of an alien texture, doesn't it? You know, it's not something we would have on
a lot about that early, that first act, that first story, and again, sort of the nature of the monolith, the alien, whatever, made me think of Await Further Instructions, which was, you know, well, I don't want to spoil it, but the concept of, you know, that was a family in a house, you know, and they're suddenly under lockdown. There's potentially some sort of alien threat or whatever in there, and they don't know what's going on. That there was a lot that seemed similar to that, but in a kind of a Breakfast Club-y kind of scenario.
Hmm.
And I loved all the, you know, the phones were in the cupboard,
the locker, yeah.
and they're just, you know, they're locked away, they can't get to them, but they're vibrating, and you know, the again, it's all the sound design and stuff. And then suddenly planes flying overhead and everything, the what is happening on the outside, you know,
exactly.
Speculation kind of stuff, I thought was very well handled.
It was done really well, you know.
Yeah.
You really get this sort of tension. And even in the second story, when you've got the countdown, you know, because as you say, they're given 12 minutes on the other side, and you've got this sort of computer voice going like, you have 5 minutes left, you know. And it's something, what was really good about that, in that particular story, it was something that the monolith itself couldn't counter. You know, it's throwing all these images at these people, sort of saying, you know, trying to force them into a sort of alternate reality, or to accept an alternate reality. But that computer voice just keeps bringing them back, you know, sort of saying, oh, this isn't real. You know, it's going, yeah, of course it's real. But then you've got 3 minutes left. It's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, that sort of stuff really worked. But I just found it really frustrating that what we've been given is these half stories. You know, there's no conclusion to any of them.
Unfortunately. No, not at all. There's nothing.
No.
And that, like you say, it's just pure frustration.
Mm.
And it's just like, oh, look at us, we're out of party, and you know, we're trying to be hipsters, and it just doesn't work at all. And that,
you know, I felt that the most after the first story, because I was watching it. I'm thinking, I'm going to watch this all before I go to bed tonight, you know, on whatever night I was watching it. And I was really into that first story, and then it ended. And then you get the girl giving the voiceover, she's going, I am like water or something, you know, I want to be a wave. And I just went, oh, wow. My God, what's happened?
Yeah.
I thought, no, I can't deal with this now. I'm switching it off, and I'll watch it later in the morning when I'm a bit, you know, sober and not half asleep. But, it just went from, like, this really sort of tense story in a school to this, like, really pretentious sort of art house project, you know, filming waves and stuff. And it's like...
Mm.
I don't see the two sort of marrying up, but then you find out at the end that actually, no, they're not meant to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Scores on the doors for Portal, Steve.
5.
Okay. And Rich?
I will go a 6.
I'm going a six as well. This film is the opposite of the sum of its parts, basically. You know, if you look at bits in isolation, there is stuff to enjoy here. But if you're looking for a coherent narrative from start to finish, you're not going to find it. This film's going to have its supporters for sure. But I'll probably give it, now that I've sort of watched it, now I realize what it's supposed to be, I'll probably give it a rewatch. But even so, I can't get around the fact that I've been presented with five stories with no payoff to any of them.
Have you watched any of the VHS films from the same producer? Yeah. Did they do the same thing, or were they more of those old style, self-contained individual story kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, I watched the first one, and you've got these lads breaking into this house, and they find this old bloke sat in a chair, remember rightly?
Yeah.
And there's loads
of VHS, sitting around. Yeah.
So they stick one on, and that's, you know, the first story is the one that's on the video, and then come back and...
Mm.
Yeah, it's kind of all accepted, but it's just what they're watching on these VHSs.
Yeah, but they do have an actual conclusion to them. Yeah, usually whoever's filming it dies. That's basically what usually happens.
Yeah.
But when you talk about VHS 2, the last story, if I remember, is rubbish. But the first story, which is by Gareth Evans, is superb.
I didn't see the second one. Is that the one in the school?
The first story is
the Gareth Evans one.
The Gareth Evans one. It's about this documentary film crew who go to film about a cult in Indonesia, and it turns out it's like the day they've all decided to commit suicide, to bring about the end of the world sort of thing. But it's one of these stories where it turns out what the cult believes is actually true. It's really good. Really enjoyed that. But anyway. We digress. So I'm giving this a six. Steve's given it a five, and Rich has given it a
six.
A six as well. Two sixes and a five for Portal. Our final main review is The Oak Room. When Steve returns late at night to the blue-collar town he grew up in, he's there to settle a few old debts, but does so by spinning a story of something that happened up at the Oak Room. So I found out, just before we started recording, this is actually based on a play.
No! You don't say! I would never guess.
Exactly. It's another one of those sort of play adaptations. And, when you think about it, you go, yeah, of course it is, because it's basically just two guys sitting in a bar, chewing the fat, basically, shooting the shit. And that's it. That is all it is, basically, from start to finish. It starts with this hint of something going down, but the film ends before anything actually does go down. I think that's quite fair to say. There's something else happens, but Jesus, Rich, help me out here.
Well, okay, so what you have to say about this is a film about stories and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's conversations, often quite heated conversations, leading to these discussions and stories. And then the stories have stories. So there's kind of a rabbit hole thing that you kind of go through. But it is a film that gets a bit lost in itself. I love the characters. I love the performances. I think there's a lot of good stuff in here, but it isn't. You do kind of think, well, what was the point of a fair amount of it? As entertaining as it was, it's kind of irrelevant and doesn't really result in anything. So the idea that it was just, it's about storytelling rather than anything else. And obviously, one of the things about storytelling is you want to have a satisfying conclusion. So I guess I kind of was reasonably happy with the ending. I didn't mind the revelations and stuff, but you did kind of think that more of what was mentioned would come into play, and it doesn't. It's all asides.
Yeah. The ending raises a lot of questions. One is, why is this guy telling him this story in the first place? You know, does he realize the significance of what he's actually telling him?
Yeah, I think he must, because I think that's the only way it makes sense.
Yeah.
But in which case,
why is he telling it?
Yeah,
I don't know. What is his motive? What's his motive?
You know, exactly. What is the motive? Yeah, because I didn't get that. No, you're right. RJ Mitty, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his
correctly. Let's go with that. Yeah.
I'd not seen him in Breaking Bad, but we did watch Final Recall, or The Recall as it originally was, Wesley Snipes film that he was in. I didn't really notice him in that, although he was like top billed. Here, he is like the main guy, the main character who walks in, Steve. Mm. And it was I was watching him and I was thinking, is he playing him as he's got cerebral palsy? And it's like, no, he's not. He's actually an actor who has cerebral palsy, which is quite surprising, because I don't think I've ever seen a leading man, somebody cast who's got cerebral palsy. So, and the fact that they don't make in a thing of it in the movie was quite interesting. It's like an interesting character feature. Yeah. Obviously, that's not the intention. It's just he has that.
I didn't even pick up on it. I thought he just had like a cleft palate or something. You know, his speech pattern was slightly off. But other than that, I must admit, it just went over my head.
I don't think it's intended as any relevance to the story, because it's not mentioned or anything. It's just something I picked up on in his performance. And it just made me think, I just want to check this. I wasn't sure. So I thought he was really good. But the main guy, I mean, the guy he was playing opposite, who is, let me find his name, because he's one of those character actors who I've seen in absolutely tons of stuff, I'm sure. Peter Outerbridge. He was great. I think this is probably the best role I've ever seen him play, because he seems to quite often play sort of officials and stuff. Oh, he was in Saw 6. I remember. Yeah. So, okay. I'm just looking at his IMDb. He's like an official sort of character, rather than a down and dirty sort of gruff sort of character. I mean, I thought he was really, really good. I thought all the cast were very good. The cinematography, and that's really nice. The opening, the sort of enigmatic opening of the bowl, is a bit confused. Now, you've got the in media res issue. Mm-hmm. My issue is with films that show the credits, but not the title. And so this one's like showing all the details, and then the title is not until the very end of the opening. Because that just froze me completely, because I'm just waiting for the... Because, you know, usually when the title doesn't appear in the usual sequence, you usually have a scene plays out, and then suddenly, boom, it's like a punctuation mark. You know, the title comes up. And if I don't get that, I'm just waiting for it. And then it's only like after 10 minutes or whatever that I actually settle down. So that's a personal problem that I had with the structure of the movie. But apart from that, I thought all the storytelling stuff was really good. But the fact that it didn't really lead anywhere was an issue.
I agree. I mean, I think the cinematography is superb. You know, the actual the lighting of the bar and everything. I think that works really well. The actual the photography, all the the setups, shot composition, that sort of thing. Really, really good. I thought that the first segment, which takes place at the Oak Room, that was a Shaggy Dog story, and it goes nowhere.
That's the term I was trying to think of. Shaggy Dog.
You know, it really does go no. I mean, you know, even the bartender's sort of like up, you know, sort of frustrated, going, what the fuck? You know, I've had better shits than that story sort of thing. But then, you know, it makes sense when you get the, as he said, and it was weird when he goes, oh, that's, you know, you need to hear the earlier part. It's like, what the fuck? You've literally just told a story which is in media res.
Why? What was his motivation? Why is he messing with him?
Yeah, exactly. You know, why is he doing this? This is the guy who looked after his dad and everything, you know, who he basically owes a debt to. Why is he fucking with him like this? It's really bizarre. And then, you know, there's another bit, isn't there, where he makes a phone call to this guy saying, oh, you know, Paul's here or something, you need to come down. And then you're not sure, you know, Paul reckons he's bluffing. You're not sure, but you know somebody's on the way down, you know, because we get these little scenes. But again, you know, there's no backstory. They don't sort of go into what happened in the past or anything like that. You know, why are these guys in, you know, in inverted commas, interested to have a little chat with him? You know, it's all surface, basically, what we end up getting. As fascinating as you know, some of the content actually is, we don't really sort of learn a lot about what's going on.
No. So, yeah, I mean, where does that leave you in terms of feeling like it? Is it something you'd recommend? Or
I kind of would, but I would have to add a caveat saying, you know, because I don't think it's been marketed as a thriller or even a horror movie. You know, when I was sort of watching, when I was looking up details for Death Ranch on IMDb, he's sort of saying, oh, you may be interested in The Oak Room. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm looking forward to seeing this now, because, you know, after watching For the Sake of Vicious and Death Ranch, which are both very sort of gory, sort of vicious films. And here's IMDb saying, oh, you may be interested in The Oak Room. I'm like, okay. But then you watch it and you're going, no, people who watch The Death Ranch shouldn't be watching The Oak Room.
No, there's a horror element, but it's not really. But one of the films that came to mind when I was watching it was a film Kevin Spacey directed and starred in as well, called Albino Alligator, which I seem to remember that was like, that all takes place in a bar.
Mm-hmm. Was that not Steve Buscemi?
Matt Dillon and Gary Sinise were in it with Faye Dunaway. I think I'm not sure if Kevin Spacey was actually in it, but he did direct it anyway. Viggo Mortensen and there's loads of people were in it. I mean, it's a good cast. I mean, I don't really remember much about the film apart from the fact that it was like a drama kind of thing that took place in a bar This was similar in that respect. Also, you know, there's other stuff like Feast, which obviously is a horror movie that takes place in a bar. If you want a horror movie in a bar, check out Feast, because that's pretty good fun. I did like it, and I would recommend it. I think, but you have to. It is a play kind of experience that really is not about a singular story. It's a bit similar, funnily enough, to like what we were saying with Doors or Portal, I should say. But in it, you know, it is kind of introducing lots of stuff and then not actually having it be relevant to the overarching story and actually not actually completing that story in a particularly
Exactly. As Milhouse would say in The Simpsons, when are they getting to the fireworks factory? So anyway, okay, Rich, scores on the Doors.
I'm going to go 6 out of 10 again on this one.
Yep, I'll have to agree with you. Another 6 for this one. So 2 6s this week for The Oak Room. Check it out. Our short shots this week are C600 and C600 Infiltration. When a robot replicant goes wrong, a technician is sent in to terminate it, but not all is as it seems. So a bit of sort of, I don't know, what would you say? A bit of Blade Runner, a bit of humans going on here, a bit of Westworld. We're in a situation where people have these robotic companions, shall we call them. This guy's got a C600 model. A technician turns up at his apartment to fix it or get rid of it. And the owner of it is nowhere to be found. And the unit itself is acting very strange. Over to Steve.
Yeah, again, this is a strange one for me. Again, to me, yeah, it reminded me of, like, the first part reminded me of humans. You know, he goes in, there's obviously an issue with it. But then they start dancing.
Yeah.
Which completely threw me. I'm like, what? What's going on? If they've started fighting, fair enough. But they're not. They're doing, like, interpretive dance in a kitchen.
Yeah.
And then it just ends. And it was just the strangest thing I've seen. And the second one started. And obviously the character whose voice you hear in the first one, it's now in her work environment. And as he's coming back. And then, what is it? His body, the robot is now in his body.
Yep.
And yeah, I'm trying to.
And he's in her body. Now,
yeah. And he's in her body. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just. But it's all been set up by a guy who used to run the company and now wants to take it over again. And it was just. They were kind of well shot, but. Obviously, they were done on the cheap because it's basically just a kitchen and an office room. It just threw me. Can you guys explain the dancing at all?
No, but I loved it. I must admit, I thought, especially you know, her dancing when she does it on her own. I thought that was absolutely superb. Her movements look really cool. But then when he started dancing as well. Yeah, as you say, it just totally threw me. I was thinking maybe is he an android as well and doesn't realise, you know, a bit of Blade Runner there, you know. And
yeah.
It's very bizarre that he suddenly just joins in and just says, yeah, let's dance, you know. And they're both really good at it, you know. It's as I said, it's great to watch. It doesn't make a lick of sense, but it's great to watch for as long as it lasts.
Yeah, the... That is the sort of defining feature of it that stood out to me was that interpretive dance angle, because it just completely sideswipes you. You think it's going to be a fight scene or an action scene of some sort, and then it goes that way. And I think that's an interesting idea of, you know, is the agent, is he a robot but he doesn't realize it? That would help it make more, the second part make more sense of where the consciousness transferred and such. So this first C600 short came out last year and is written and directed by a very prolific filmmaker called Blake Ridder. Mm-hmm. And he's just, at the time of recording, he's just released the follow-up, which I enjoyed more. What really struck me is how he's expanded on the world of what originally seemed like quite a quirky standalone.
Yeah,
he's with a surprising sort of open-ended sort of payoff, but he picks up directly from that first film, brings all the, you know, all the cast is back, all the characters, it all links in. I did before recording tonight, I've watched them again back to back, and it does make it so much easier to follow through that story of what is actually happening. And we do end on another open-ended conclusion. I love the way the climax happens on part two. Part two is a bit longer as well, so it's different environments, more environments, so it's two environments and it's about 17 minutes. And, you know, we got three or four characters this time. I think it's four characters, isn't it? The way it ends, you know, it's kind of one of those, you know, it's that Deep Rising thing, isn't it? what is it? What's he say at the end of that movie? Can't remember. But it's
now
like,
what?
Oh, now what? Yeah, kind of thing. And then, you know, and the credits kick in. And the credits kick in with, you know, the really stylish and great music and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I like this. This is really good. I can't wait for the next part. I think the actress who plays the C600, which is actually is it X900? You know, they think it's a C600. It's actually an X9. Megan DeCrook, who is, I believe, a trained dancer as well as an actress. Mm. She's really good. I love the sound design, you know, the way the sound editing is all done, because in the second part, the agent, she is speaking, but you're hearing the agent's voice. Yeah. And I think the sync that they've done with that is really good. Her mannerisms and acting as the robot and the dancing, as you say, was really good. Brought to mind to me what I was saying in previous episode about Devil's Machine, also called Automata.
Yeah.
You know, the way that performance, you know, there's a dance sequence in there, the way that was conveyed between, you know, robots. You know, the two are comparable, I would say. She's really good. Then the agent, the guy playing the agent is really good. They're all actually... The whole cast is good, and there's a nice little making of about the second film, which sort of takes you in shows you where they shot and how they, you know, did the lighting and stuff. So that's worth watching. I think I've seen a few of Blake Ritter's films, but not a huge amount. He's done loads, and a couple of them haven't blown me away. So I've been a bit shy of, you know, spending too much time on them. But I think this one is, you know, the new one, Infiltration, has really sold me on him as a filmmaker. And I really want to, you know, sort of delve into a bit more about what he's done. I can't wait for what they do with part three.
Mm. Yeah, I'm on board, I have to say. Any other comments, guys? We don't score the shorts.
No, I think I've said enough.
Yeah,
I'll check out the next one, but yeah.
You know, the second one is mainstream, but it, you know, it's more mainstream than the first one, but it still has those quirks. You know, it opens up with some silly, you know, with like a silly dance scene, which is actually the opening scene of the second one is taking place before the first film. Mm. So it's a flash, you know, it's a flashback or prequel sort of scene. And it all sort of puts it in context. I think they're developing the story really nicely. The second one, unlike the dancing, you know, we got a little bit of the dancing, but there is actual action in the second one.
Yeah,
we got some martial arts choreographed by David Chung and Yolanda Lyons, who've done various things. There was a short film they did called The Real Target, which I think you've seen, Mike.
Yes, yeah.
But I really want to see it, but it's not available anywhere. Desperate to see that.
Yeah, Fighting Spirit, one of the Fighting Spirit film festivals a few years ago.
So I really would like to see that. They've got quite a few credits. You know, they've worked on other things. They're a good team. So it's good to have that they're involved. That brings something else to the project. It's a really, really good... you have to see the first one. You can't just come in on the second one because it just won't make as much...
Would not make any sense. Yeah, no. So you know, on that note, we will be putting both of the... links to both films into the footnotes, so please check them out. And since we're talking about short films, do check out our DTV Short Shots
Twitter
page, which is Twitter, and Short Shots podcast as well, which is a bit intermittent, but there are a few episodes available at the moment. Our DTV throwback this week is Mercenary for Justice. A mercenary gets involved in a mission that threatens the lives of his kin. What? I'm reading this for the first time off IMDb. It's bollocks. It really is. Excuse me.
That's not true.
It's just not true, is it? Okay, let's do that again. So, Steven Seagal plays John Seeger, the best mercenary there ever was, who finds himself betrayed by his CIA masters who are working for some guy called Chapel. Yeah, some weird guy called Anthony Chapel who's pulling the strings on everything, and he's got the most annoying voice ever. Rich, you are our resident Seagull fan / archivist. Where do you stand on this film?
Well, this is one of those films from Seagull's 2000s. This is 2006. This came out that I've always gone back and forth on whether I like it or not, because I don't think it makes any sense, and it's really confusing. But unlike some of the later or even around the same period films that he made, there's a lot of production value. The funny thing is that a lot of that production value is spent in the first 20 minutes on some, again, a scene that really probably wasn't necessary. It's like a completely different movie. It's a low budget Saving Private Ryan kind of sequence where there's loads of stuff happening. They got helicopters, they got tanks. You know, you don't get to see this kind of stuff in most of Steven Seagal's films from this point onward. So this is kind of a little bit of a last hurrah, but once that's over with, you never see anything to that level again. It's all of a fairly more standard ilk. So I like that. I like some of the characters. I like some of the acting or whatever. But it is, you know, it's got some. There is some style to the film, which is made by directed by Don Fauntleroy, who also did Today You Die, which I have a soft spot for as well, and Renegade Justice, which is probably the best, most straightforward film of that time, in which Seagal's actually in it quite a lot. Which, funnily enough, I was listening to an interview with Fauntleroy, and it kind of, that third film kind of soured their relationship, so they never worked together again. And the reason it soured their relationship was Seagal was needed on set. there was no one to cut to or have anything else, and it needed to be close-ups or whatever, so it can be a double. So we've got Seagal here for the most part, although they cut away, but there's a bit of the old, you know, doublings, and you know, his double climbing through windows and walking along, or there's a group of people walking, and you're saying, well, surely Seagal should be at the front, you know, leading them. And it's like, no, actually, they've put him at the back, slightly obscured, because it's his double. You know, he's standing doing some of those scenes. They show him at the beginning, but then you don't actually see him for like another 10 minutes. And there's lots of opportunities to cut away and spend time with other characters. So there's a whole prison assault sequence, you know, the biggest sequence in the two biggest sequences in the film, I'd say, are not involving him, which is kind of a pattern for his movies. But yeah, I do have a soft spot for this one, but I've watched it many times. I just watched it again. I can't figure it out. Could you?
No, I already couldn't. So we've got this opening bit where we've got this character called, what's he called? Ruslan or something?
So you got Dresham, played by Luke Goss.
Yeah, he's the CIA guy who's on the take, at the very least. But he's in bed with this sort of British guy called Chapel.
Chapel, yeah, who's a...
Who's faced like this all of the time. Oh my God. It's annoying.
Yeah, Luke Goss is playing American, even though he's English, and Roger Gunvar Smith is playing English, even though he's American. But he's playing him like Dr. Evil. But I like him. I like his performance in this.
He's always talking like this.
Yeah. I don't know. The way he delivers his lines, it's really unique.
Yes, there is that. It's certainly unique. So, this weird situation at the beginning, where the CIA has hired this mercenary team to go in and do something on this island, but then the French get involved. So these mercenaries kidnap the French ambassador and his family and kill them.
They get blown apart, kids and everything.
The only one who survives is the dog, because he got left behind. But that's all beside the point, because then it turns out the real story is this guy Chapel using Seagal again to help get this Egyptian guy's son out of this gulag prison, basically. But for some reason, that gulag prison is in South Africa. And for some reason, Luke Goss's character seems to think that Seagal's going to be knocking over a bank. And he's got no fucking clue that this whole prison break thing's going on at all. It's just so bizarre.
Watching it again after it's like umpteenth time, I'm pretty sure that... So you've got this character called Maxine who's kind of going between two of them. And I think they give her some misinformation to give to Dresham. And that's why they start involving the whole bank thing. But then they actually go and rob a bank,
yeah,
which was a bit confusing.
It's a double bluff, yeah.
Yeah, because the whole thing is Seagal, in the opening sequence, Seagal loses an old friend who then he has to swear that he'll sort of protect the family.
We're told that they're old friends. They get one line of dialogue each, you know, and that's it. You know, we get told by various people, go, oh yeah, they're best friends. You know, if you want to get Seagal involved in this, then you need to get
we had to get him so that we could get Seagal, who's the best and stuff. And the now I again, this is so another thing I hadn't picked up on until watching it this time, because in Sniper, I was watching a sort of commentary, people having a go at Sniper Special Ops, and they were like, he's firing a sniper rifle, whatever. He's not even taking off his sunglasses. And I was like realizing this actually goes all the way back to this film, maybe before that, of him being in a combat situation, firing an automatic, you know, a powerful automatic weapon, wearing sunglasses. Yeah. Would that be a standard thing, or should it? Is that like a really stupid thing to be doing? to be wearing sunglasses.
I think certainly with the sniper rifle. Do you remember when we watched the film with Mark Dacascos called Sabotage? There's a whole bit in that where he's telling Carrie Ann Moss about the thing called the idiot cut. Like when you fire a sniper rifle, the recoil. You know, if you're too close to the holding it right, the rifle's going to recoil and hit you in the face, basically, and you get what's called the idiot cut. And I think that's kind of what they're alluding to. You know, you got the recoil; it's going to smash right into your sunglasses. You know?
So we've got him, and that whole sequence ends, and it sort of ends on a, you know, they do this whole, you know, the horror of war kind of montage kind of thing.
Well, that's the thing as well. Okay, so their big thing is just to sort of jump in a helicopter and leave. You know, after blowing up the French ambassador's family, they get in a helicopter and just leave. I'm thinking, what? No airplanes that can just take it? You know, they're in the sky. They're a fucking sitting duck. You know, just take them out. It's a weird setup. It really is.
Yeah, and the whole what they're doing there and how they were screwed over or whatever, it isn't really explained. So then we go to Florida, where we've got the widow and her son. And Steven Seagal is reintroduced at that point. I just want to say in the previous scene, in the wartime scene, he is intermittently dubbed. He's actually, the first line of dialogue he delivers in the movie is by someone else. And so then we're reintroduced to him with some funky sort of, typical Steven Seagalian country style bluesy music, which reintroduces his character and changes the whole tone of the movie. And he goes there and he says that he's going to swear to, you know, to look after them and everything's going to be okay. And basically because of him, they then get kidnapped straight away.
Yeah.
And he ends up going to meet up with Chapel again, who he's like, no, I don't really want to work with you anymore. And then they go, oh, actually, we're holding these people hostage, so you've got to. And he's kind of like,
All right then.
Okay. And then this is where we start to see Seagal buried in shadows he's got like really bad skin and stuff in this. He does not look well in a lot of the close-ups, and there are a lot of close-ups, and they try to use all the lighting and stuff. So that's really weird as well. But then, so we get to the laying out the plan, and you know, we're going to break this guy out of prison, whatever, which he doesn't take part in. He's basically sitting in a car, and he's like, it's a go kind of thing, and everyone else does it, and then it's like, oh, actually, we're playing it with, you know, it's not what, it's not what you think's happening. We're crossing you because we're trying to get back on you because we don't like you for what you did.
Mm.
In because they're trying to get back on these Afrikaans mercenaries. And the idea is that Seagal is ethically much better than they are, but then his subsequent actions show him to be no better at all, because then we've got a bank robbery sequence.
He kills a lot of cops.
And, completely cold-bloodedly.
And security guards, just because they're in his way.
Yeah, so he kills a couple, at least. Maxine is with him. She just, you know, offs like three people. They were just, you know, they're in the bank just doing their job.
Yeah.
Or cop or police officers or whatever. You know, they're completely innocent. And that's always been the part of the film that I've struggled with the most. I mean, there's a history of Seagal doing this kind of thing. I mean, I was watching on Deadly Ground recently, and there's that really cool bit where he's got the gun and he puts a bottle on the end to use as a silencer.
Right.
And then holds it up to the door and he kind of goes sort of knock, knock, and gets the person to come over and then shoots him in the face. And then I was kind of watching that thinking, well, hang on a minute, isn't this just like an oil worker? he wasn't any threat whatsoever. They've just killed him for the sake of it, for the guffo. Anyway, so so that is like that completely weird. And then that whole sequence ends on a sort of a jaunty caper, you know, we got away with it kind of. No, not like, oh, sure, you've just mercilessly, brutally killed these poor guys who were just trying to do that. I mean, backtrack slightly to the bank robbery, which is just completely ridiculous. They just basically walk in and they stand next to a computer terminal and just send the money wherever they want. Sure. And it's not Mission Impossible, that's for sure.
No, I've seen Seagal on wires. I don't want to see him suspended from the ceiling. Now, interestingly, after I watched this the other day, I decided to go back into Seagal's heyday and watch something, you know, from one of the sort of more classics, shall we say. And I went for Out for Justice.
No, I watched that myself recently as well.
Yeah. Now, what is interesting about that is the amount of effort he puts into his character's accent. You know, the whole film is basically about, you know, the fact that these characters grew up together in this Brooklyn area. So, like, you know, he's going for the sort of American Italian accent and all this, you know, the kind of, and he's put, he compare the that amount of effort to what he does now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in Out for Justice, which he does have a great ensemble around him, but he is on screen a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And he is committed. And that is the kind of film that shows you why he was a big deal, why he was the big star that he was, because he was, you know, okay, he was experimenting with accents and stuff even then, but it came across really well, I thought. There's bits, the character stuff that he does in that film, you know, the little bit, there's
the laugh, you know, the way he's laughs and stuff.
And he's got the story, you know, he goes, he's got that old friend, because he's from the neighborhood, story, whatever. Yeah, yeah. He tells the story, hey, whoever thought I would grow up to be a cop and all that kind of stuff, you know, it works. The whole thing just, it's perfect. Yeah. It really works. I mean, they throw in some stuff about him rescuing a dog and stuff, which I think that to me is Seagal being a movie star and adding that in because he's a dog lover and stuff, because otherwise it doesn't really fit. But that does actually give a nice other dimension to his character as well. So I can appreciate why they did do that. But that's a nice one to mention, because Out for Justice, obviously the reason this is called Mercenary for Justice is because of that. This was actually shot as Mercenary. That was what it was going to be originally called. And they thought, oh, we've got to make it more Seagal. So let's add For Justice at the end, which just makes it just sort of seem a joke, really, which to an extent it is. I mean, there's the opening sequence where those Afrikaans mercenaries who are dubbed, either played by Americans or dubbed with American accents, because they do not sound like they're South African at all.
No.
It's those two guys, you know, heavily, you know, dressed up with, you know, camouflage gear and all that, whatever, but with a girl in a skimpy top along for the ride. It's just like, well, Madraff was watching it when we said, so why is she dressed like that? And I was thinking, exactly, it's ridiculous.
It was literally in the middle of a war zone. You know, it's like if, you know, if Tia Carrera walked out of True Lies and ended up in like Syria or something like that. It's like, you know, it just did not compute. And the, you know, the reasoning for it as well just didn't make any sense.
I think she was supposed to be just like a distraction, you know, that her looks were supposed to be a distraction, but they don't make enough of that to be the actual reason. The reason she's dressed like that is to be eye candy in the film. That's the sole thing. But so there's lots of, I mean, this was all shot for, well, it was shot in Bulgaria and Cape Town, but there's a lot of Cape Town stuff. A lot of all the sets and things were built in there. I think apparently Seagal spent like several months in Cape Town doing it. The looking at where Seagal was in his career, you know, his lifestyle and that at that point, I'll just say that there was an article about him visiting a children's hospital over there. And it said he was dressed in a brown and gold silk Mandarin jacket, accompanied by an entourage of 15 assistants, bodyguards and Buddhist monks for the tour of the hospital. So this is the bubble. This is the sort of entourage lifestyle that he's living at this point. And the film also is notable for being part of a lawsuit that some of the producers took against him. So he did this and Today You Die. And in both of those, they said, you know, he was making unreasonable demands, or he wasn't turning up, or he was changing things and, you know, just being difficult, which it was settled out of court, but you can believe it. I do, you know, subsequent films have shown what his reputation is. And I can completely believe that this film was compromised by that lack of participation that he was prepared to. Now, there's been an article recently, I can't remember if it was New Yorker or something, about the producer, Randall Emmett. I don't know if you've read it, which is, it's well worth checking out, because he basically outlines his process of pulling together these movies like the Bruce Willis ones, where they get a good payday. They only have to work, you know, like for like 10 minutes in the movie. They get the high billing or whatever, you know, it's easy work for them. And it all kind of stems back to Seagal, is where it all kind of started from. And this is one of those films. This is an Emmett Furler
production. Seagal did go on, you know, I mean, as you say, 2006, he's doing the body doubles, his voice has been dubbed.
Yeah.
Stuff. A couple of years later, like 2009, 2010, he was doing films like A Dangerous Man, Born to Raise Hell, where he did seem to be more involved and actually on the screen and doing stuff, you know.
Well, Dangerous Man, I'd say not, because there's a whole massive ensemble of characters in that help you. You know, he's off screen for a huge amount of time in there. But in terms of some of the action or whatever, I'd say, yeah, Born to Raise Hell, I think, was a bit more of a personal project.
He wrote that one, didn't he? With that one, he was sort of drawing on his own experience as being sheriff in Alabama.
The stuff that it came out around, it was all around the same time as the Steven Seagal Lawman TV series.
That's right.
But it's got that weird thing is that it was obviously made to be in America, but they had to film it in Romania. So some of it just doesn't make sense. It's an interesting movie. But
It's got Darren Shalavi as the baddie in that one as well, which helps.
So they get a little bit of a...
there was that little period where I thought, Pistol Whipped, I think, was the other one, and The Keeper, where you think, he seems to sort of turn a bit of a corner. And then,
And
then it just went downhill again.
He started to... using all the proxy,
Almost as if he thought, I think him and Bruce Willis have both sort of like looked at their involvement in these things and worked out that the amount of effort they have to put in compared to actually putting in some effort for the success of the film is negligible. You know, there's probably some sort of formula or a Venn diagram that sort of says, okay, you know, if I put in this much of an effort compared to actually sort of giving a shit and doing this and, you know, really investing in the project. The actual outcome in terms of monetary, you know, some box office or whatever, is pretty minimal between the two. So why bother, you know? So I think that's what he does. It's like, well, okay, you know, it doesn't matter if I turn up for 2 days or 20 days to do the film. The outcome's more or less going to be the same. You know, people are going to eat, the fans are going to eat it up. Everyone else is going to stay away.
Yeah, and I think with this one, he is the main star. He's certain, you know, there's no question about that. He's got some solid support from Luke Goss, who he would later do Killing Salazar with as well, which is a, you know, you if you put those two films side by side, you can see the drop in quality quite clearly. This feels, I mean, in part due to the fact that it was made in South Africa, where you get a lot more for your money.
Yeah.
This has a much better, you know, great locations and good, you know, good sequences, and there's some nice stuff. With a bit more polishing, with a bit more care and attention, this would have been a good movie. And a better editor. And yeah, they've kind of gone, oh, actually, we can't really completely do this bit, so we're just going to have that bit, and then we can't really do this bit fully. Because the whole thing about rescuing the sun and everything, it's one of those things where they introduce all these plot threads that actually they drop, or they just sort of close off very quickly. And this, you know, I think he'd done Submerged prior to, he had done Submerged prior to this, and that's another case. Yeah, I mean, I have quite a fondness for that, but also to say Today You Die, but they become needlessly convoluted by virtue of the production problems that are encountered.
Yes.
It's not necessarily the original script wasn't there. It's like the script changes, or they do things, or he doesn't want to do something, or they have to work around it, and, you know, things get left. I mean, I'm sure there must be some, you know, explanation there as to why things just didn't quite pan out with this story. I mean, the whole thing about the widow and her son is so incidental to the whole thing. The other thing I want to mention is the boy is apparently supposed to be scared. He never looks scared at all.
He hardly looks up from his phone.
He hardly reacts or anything. It's like, oh yeah, and they're like, he's only a little boy. He's so scared, and it's like, he doesn't even act scared or anything, but that's she tries anyway. But it's that bank sequence where they've gone, oh yeah, we've got to have a bit bigger body count, but we're not going to do anything that might actually justify, you know, thematically or narratively of why he should do that, apart from just that that maybe he is as cold-blooded a mercenary as the guys he felt he was better than, which does actually fit quite well with Seagal's character in his in personal life, because he always sets himself as being, you know, better than everyone else, when actually some of his behaviour is a hell of a lot worse.
Just a few observations about this one. We get this sort, you know, putting the team together bit at the beginning, with the guys sort of reading out things. The clips they use for each character are actually clips from the film that we haven't actually seen yet, which is one thing. And then Seagal's character is introduced as being the most highly decorated officer from the Gulf War or something.
Oh, yeah.
Of course he is. Of course he is. The most interesting character in this actually is a character called Bulldog, who we're introduced as, well, help me out here, Rich, because he starts off as being sort of the allocated driver for Seagal's character. But I'm wondering who actually allocated it. You know, was it the CIA guys, or was it Chapel? Because by that stage, you know, he's been sort of coerced into doing this stuff, and he's given this guy Bulldog to sort of drive around. And he starts off being, you know, totally silent and sort of a bit cajoling from Seagal. He goes, oh, I bet you're from Detroit. He's going, yeah, I'm from Detroit.
In a dubbed voice.
But he becomes this sort of lovable character, you know, in almost like Seagal's sidekick, which is just really bizarre, you know. So there's that.
Yeah, that could have been something that they developed along the way as, you know, something. I don't know. But yeah, he does kind of come out of nowhere. And yeah, they don't really introduce him as like a specialist in anything.
he's like the janitor sort of thing. But what
did you think about the scene where, so Seagal is in the car with Luke Goss. The police are just about to come. And then Seagal slips out the door, gets into a van, and then the van drives off just as the police officer is getting to the car.
I know. Yeah.
like a second or less than a second, he manages
very
to magic himself away. And they go, oh, he's like a ghost. Which, again, is another theme of some Seagal films. They're always calling him a ghost.
The Glimmer Man, all that, the other bit, which is quite amusing, and I suppose this comes down to sort of like how many takes they could be bothered to do. The very end of the film, bad guy gets into his limo and drives off, but of course Seagal's put a bomb on it. And they're sort of going, oh, you're only going to let him go away? And he's going, no, of course not. And he fumbles the bloody control. And he's like, okay, so he says some sort of one-liner, but he's sort of like, oh, wait. Where's the fucking button? And then presses it. There's this sort of like really sort of prolonged delay between him saying the line and then actually getting around to pressing the button. And it's like, we can't be bothered to do another take. So he's pressed the button, fuck it.
And the thing is, there's also in that sequence, there's a joke that he makes in between the two scenes that seems like it was added in because his character is not in as jovial a mood in the very next thing that he says. So it's kind of, it's a bit of an awkward scene, but in terms of, again, going back to production value, that's a great explosion.
Oh, it is a very good explosion. Actually, two very good explosions. The thing with the, you know, the armoured car, I thought that was...
Yeah, the armoured vehicle.
Very good. But anyway, so yeah, this is, you know, it is from a troublesome period in Seagal's long filmography.
What, you mean the last 20 years? I love the guy, but come on, let's be honest. The last 20 years have been troublesome.
Have you seen Master Commander yet? General Commander.
I have seen General Commander, and this is you know out for justice compared to General Commander. This is absolutely. I mean, this is it's always gone consistently downhill. And if you watched any of his recent films, you go back and watch this. And it's kind of a breath of fresh air, really, because there is so much more
that you get out of it. The one thing about this film, at least this one, he doesn't have the goatee.
Well, he only started to do that in after about 2011 when he played
special ops and things like that.
Yeah, he did it in Force of Execution when he was playing a gang boss, and he was like, actually, I'm going to keep this. And he's kind of kept it ever since. I like it, actually. I don't mind the goatee.
It looks ridiculous. Anyway, okay, again, we do not score the DTV throwbacks.
But do you recommend it?
That's what I was about to say. I was going to choke on my own words then. I can't recommend it. You know, there are far better films out there to check out. If you are a Seagal fan, and
you've probably already said it.
Either you've seen it or you haven't. If you're intrigued by what we've been talking about and want to see it for yourself, it's on Prime. You know, it's just turned up on Prime. Why not check it out? Hopefully next week we'll have something better for you to check out. But in the meantime, there it is, Mercenary for Justice. It's on Prime. We've watched it. I think that's basically what we're saying.
What's interesting about the fact that it's come on Prime, it's been re-released by Signature Entertainment. It's also available from its original distributor, also on Amazon, you know, but you have to pay-per-view it. So they did new art for this one. So there's two different listings from two different distributors live at the same time. So if you're a Prime subscriber, don't, you know, look out for the one with Prime. Don't pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
If you want to buy it, you can pay, I think you can pick it up for like £3 on DVD or something. But
indeed. Yeah. Anyway, that is the end of this week's show. A very interesting mix of films. Certainly interesting to talk about. Hope you enjoyed what we had to say. Thanks to Rich and Steve for joining me this evening.
No problems.
Awesome.
Oh, that's great.
In your case. So don't forget to check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at the DTV Digest. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts, the DTV Digest Short Shots, where we look at exclusively at some short films in each episode. And also the Twitter page for that particular podcast, where Rich puts up a new short film every evening. So please check us out. Other than that, thank you for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.